Today I'll be talking about some work we did at Berkeley to understand performance of data analytics frameworks. This is joint work with my advisor, Sylvia Ratnasamy, as well as with Ryan Rasty, Gan Chun, and Scott Schenker. As I'm sure everyone in this room is well aware of, the use of large-scale data analytics has become widespread. As a result, there's been a ton of work, both in research and in industry, on trying to improve the performance of these frameworks. There's two basic driving forces behind these performance improvements. First, the fact that there's a huge amount of capital expenditure involved in the data centers where these frameworks are run, resulting in work trying to make them more resource efficient. And second, the fact that there's typically some end user who's waiting for a response from one of these queries, resulting in work on making them faster. Before I talk any more about performance, I'll give a quick overview of how these frameworks typically work. The setting is that you have a cluster with many machines, anywhere from tens to many hundreds of thousands of machines, and there's some data set that's broken up into pieces that are each stored on different machines. A job is broken down into tasks, where a task is the unit of work that runs on one machine. Each task does the same computation, but does so on a different piece of input data. This is the way that essentially all of these frameworks are architected, whether it's Spark or Hadoop or Dryad. This is what a simple job might look like, but more commonly, there's a first stage of tasks that generates some intermediate data and stores that data to disk. Then that data will later be read by a second phase of tasks that shuffles the data to reorganize it over the network. With this view in mind of how these frameworks work, I'll give a quick overview of some of the work that's been done targeted at improving performance in this context. First, there's been a bunch of work on trying to optimize the network. Techniques in this area range from in-network techniques, doing things like improving the way that packets are buffered at switches, to application-level techniques, doing things like trying to reduce the amount of data that the application sends over the network. There's also been work on improving disk performance, doing things ranging from trying to improve the way frameworks use the disk to reduce the number of seeks, to avoiding the disk altogether by caching data in memory. Finally, there's been work on stragglers. The problem here is that when you run a job with many parallel tasks, typically one or some small number of tasks in the job take much longer to complete than the other tasks. Unfortunately, in general, past work has had a hard time identifying the underlying cause of these stragglers and has instead focused on mitigation. The idea is to wait until you see that tasks are running slowly, and if so, relaunch the task on a different machine in the hopes that it'll complete more quickly. There's been a ton of valuable work in this area, and much of the work shown on this slide has shown impressive improvements to job completion time as a result of applying a particular optimization. But what's missing is an idea of what's most important to the end-to-end performance when you're running a data analytics workload. Instead of any kind of comprehensive performance study, what's emerged from all of this work is a set of commonly accepted mantras. These have emerged more from the improvements people have shown from applying a particular optimization rather than from any kind of end-to-end study. The mantras are first, that network and disk I/O are bottlenecks for these frameworks, and second, that stragglers are a major issue with unknown underlying cause. This work is targeted at understanding whether or not these mantras are true. To that end, we make two contributions. First, we provide a new methodology, block time analysis, to help us characterize performance bottlenecks in distributed computation frameworks. And second, we study three workloads to understand whether the mantras hold on those workloads. Based on studying these workloads, we find first that network optimizations are essentially irrelevant to end-to-end job completion time, that optimizing the network can lead to at most a 2% reduction in the completion time of jobs. Second, we find that CPU and not disk I/O is typically the bottleneck. And finally, we find that many straggler causes can be identified and fixed. You'll notice that these takeaways are significantly different than the mantras I mentioned in an earlier slide. Before I proceed with this talk, I want to take a moment to talk about what this work is not. We're not arguing that these takeaways will be true for every single data analytics workload. And similarly, we're not arguing that these takeaways will be true for all time as frameworks change. Instead, the point of this work is to point out that the accepted mantras are often not true today and to provide a methodology to help us avoid performance misunderstandings in the future. In the remainder of this talk, I'll start by presenting a methodology for how to identify and characterize performance bottlenecks. Next, I'll discuss the workloads that we use to evaluate performance and present the results of using block time analysis to understand those workloads. And finally, I'll take a deep dive into a subset of our results to understand why they differ from prior work. So first, I'll begin by talking about the methodology. We began with a simple question. When you're running one of these analytics jobs, what's the bottleneck? Unfortunately, this question doesn't have a simple answer. This is an example of what a typical job might look like. You have a bunch of parallel tasks, and I've shown time advancing along the x-axis. If you look at what's happening in one of these tasks, there's many parallel threads. Some threads are reading data over the network, some threads are doing computation, and some threads are transferring data to and from disk. This parallelism makes it very difficult to characterize the bottleneck. If you look at any one point in time, different tasks may be bottlenecked on different resources, and even if you focus on one task, that task may be bottlenecked on different resources at different points. As a result, there's typically not a single answer to the question, what is the bottleneck for one of these jobs? Instead, what we look at is characterizing the importance of each resource. So for the sake of example here, I'll focus on the network and ask, how does the network affect the job's completion time? The methodology that we use here is called blocked time analysis, and the goal of this methodology is to provide a metric to characterize if the network were infinitely fast, how much could the job improve? So this is providing a best case improvement from any optimization that's done on the network. To do this, we focus on the time when tasks are blocked on the network. The intuition here is that if the task is transferring data over the network concurrently with doing something else, optimizing the network during that part of execution can't reduce job completion time because the task is still going to be doing the something else during that time. Block time analysis involves two steps. First, we added instrumentation to measure the time when tasks are blocked on the network. And second, we used a simulation to understand how job completion time would change given the faster task completion times. I'll talk about each one of these steps in a little bit more detail. First, we measured the time when tasks are blocked on the network. So here's what a typical Spark task might look like. This is just an example task. So first, it reads a record over the network, and then it computes on that record. But what's important to understanding the task's execution is that Spark uses pervasive pipelining. So while it's computing on that record, it's also reading more records in the background. And similarly, when it writes the output to disk, it's continuing to do more computation and more network reads in the background as the task executes. For block time analysis, we focus on the compute thread, and we measure the time when it's blocked waiting on the network. So at the beginning, it's blocked on the network because it needs a record to do computation. Given these measurements, it's trivial to determine how fast the task would have completed if it had never blocked on the network. We simply subtract all of the orange times to get the new task completion time. I want to emphasize that this is a best case improvement. It's possible that if you eliminated the network, the task would have spent more time blocked on disk, so would have taken longer to complete than the example that I've shown. For all of our metrics, we focus on the best case improvement. So this is an optimistic look at what's the best case improvement you could get from optimizing network performance. Next, given all of these measurements, the second step is to simulate how job completion time would change. This is a simple job that has three tasks that run in two slots. And using the methodology I described on the previous slide, we have measurements for how long each task spends blocked on the network. You might be thinking that it's also trivial now to determine the job's completion time. We could just subtract all of these orange times for each slot to find when the job would have completed. The problem is that doing this doesn't account for the way that the scheduler works. In fact, if the network's time had been eliminated, task one completed so much faster that task two would have run in a different slot. So this is how we simulate the job's completion time, and accounting for these kind of metrics we found made a big difference in seeing this best case possible improvement. To summarize, I've described block time analysis, which tells us how quickly a job could have completed if a resource were infinitely fast. Next, I'll talk about the workloads that we use to measure performance. You might be wondering whether we can use large-scale traces. There's a couple of traces available that provide aggregate metrics about jobs run in these frameworks. Unfortunately, none of the traces that are available to us have enough instrumentation to do block time analysis. So instead, we need to focus on a set of workloads that we can run ourselves to add the appropriate instrumentation. We focus on SQL workloads that we run on Spark. First, a TBCDS workload. TBCDS is a workload that was developed to try and model what typical use of an analytics framework looks like. In this talk, I'll talk about running that workload on 20 machines. We've also run it on larger clusters of 60 and 200 machines, and I won't talk about those results further today. We also ran it, ran a big data benchmark. This was a workload that was developed at Berkeley to try and understand performance of analytics frameworks. And finally, we were able to instrument a production workload running at Databricks. For each of these workloads, we ran two versions, one version that stored input and output data in memory, and a second version that stored input and output data on disk. Before I present the results, I want to point out three limitations here. First, the fact that we focus on a single framework. Second, the fact that we looked at only three workloads. And finally, the fact that we looked at relatively modest cluster sizes. I'll return to these limitations at the end of the talk to argue that they're not fatal to our takeaways. Next, I'll present the results of running block time analysis on these workloads. The first thing that we looked at is how much faster jobs could get as a result of optimizing network performance. What you're looking at here to focus on one of the workloads is a box and whiskers plot. So the middle is the median, and then the whiskers represent the 5th and 95th percentiles. What this result is telling us is for this big data benchmark workload, the median improvement you could get from eliminating all time blocked on the network is 2%, and at the 95th percentile, the improvement is 10%. Looking more broadly across all of these workloads, they all have very modest improvements from eliminating the network. The best case median improvement across all of the workloads is at most 2% from eliminating time blocked on the network. Here's that same metric, except that instead we eliminated all time spent blocked on disk. We find that the disk is somewhat more important than the network, but nonetheless, the possible improvements are quite a bit lower than what we would have expected given the community mantras. We find that eliminating disk can result in a median improvement to job completion time of at most 19%. I want to mention one thing here. The reason you're seeing a distribution here is because each workload has a bunch of different jobs, and the different jobs in the workload are affected differently by the disk or by the network. Now, you may be wondering how important the CPU is. Unfortunately, we can't do block time analysis on CPU because it's very difficult to understand when a task is blocked on CPU. The OS, for example, may be doing a bunch of I/O in the background. So instead, to understand the impact of CPU, we look at these utilization metrics. This graph is showing the utilization of the network, the disk, and the CPU for each of the workloads we ran. What you can see from this graph is that the CPU is much more highly utilized than either the disk or the network. So for most of the jobs that we ran, they are bottlenecked on CPU and not on I/O. Finally, I'll talk for a minute about stragglers. We demonstrate in the paper, using the same simulation we used for block time analysis, that for the workloads we ran, there's at most a 5 to 10% improvement from mitigating stragglers. We talk about this takeaway more in the paper and what it means relative to other work. The other, I think the more interesting part of this is that we found that with the instrumentation we added for block time analysis, we were able to understand the cause of most of the stragglers in the workloads we ran. The reason that this is important is because it meant that in many cases we could fix the underlying cause. And in many cases, fixing the cause of stragglers also improved other tasks' performance as well. So we found one example in an early workload we ran where there was a configuration issue that was leading to stragglers, and fixing that configuration sped up all of the tasks, resulting in a 2x improvement to job completion time. To summarize, I've presented three takeaways based on the Spark workloads that we ran. First, that network optimizations are almost irrelevant to job completion time. Second, that CPU is typically the bottleneck. And finally, that many straggler causes can be identified and fixed. I'll spend the remainder of this talk digging into why, asking why it is that our results differ so much from prior work. Because this is NSDI, I'll focus on the network results for this part of the talk. So when we got these results, we started asking, what's going on here? And our first hypothesis was maybe the workloads we measured were unusually network light. Maybe they're using the network less than other workloads that people have looked at, and that's why we're seeing that the network is not very important to performance. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, there's not enough instrumentation in other traces to do something like blocked time analysis. So we started asking, are there any metrics that we can use to understand how the network demands of our workload compare to the large-scale traces that were used to motivate prior work? To this end, we look at this aggregate metric for each task, looking at how much data is transferred per CPU second that the task was running. So this is providing a sense of the task's network demands relative to the amount of CPU that it's using. Here I've shown this metric just for the workloads we ran. This is useful mainly so we can compare to larger scale traces. On the right-hand side, this is that same metric for a Facebook trace that was collected from one of Facebook's Hadoop clusters with many thousands of machines. What you can see here is that the Facebook workload, if anything, sends less data over the network per CPU second. So if anything, it uses the network less than the workloads we ran. This doesn't support the conclusion that our workloads are network light. We looked at the same metric for traces from Microsoft and Google. For these traces, there's much less information available. There's only aggregate information about all of the jobs. But nonetheless, the average data transferred over the network is on par with the workloads we ran. It doesn't give us reason to believe that our workloads were network light. So I started with this question of why our results differ from prior work. And we rejected this hypothesis that maybe our workloads are network light. Instead, we found two reasons we could quantify why prior work came to different conclusions. First, the fact that prior work used incomplete metrics, and second, that it conflated CPU and network time. First, I'll talk about the incomplete metrics. This is what a typical simple MapReduce job might look like. There's map tasks that read input data, then there's a shuffle, and then there's reduce tasks that write the output data. If you look at when the network is used here, it's used at two points. First, to shuffle the intermediate data between the map and reduce phases, and second, to replicate the output data. A lot of the work that looks at network performance focuses only on one of these one of the network phases. For example, looking only at the time spent shuffling data. So we ask how realistic this is by looking at how much data is shuffled or how much data is output relative to the amount of input data. This graph is showing the ratio, and what you can see is that in the best case, the shuffled data for the workloads we ran is only about a third of the input data, and there's even less output data. In other words, it's not realistic to look only at the shuffle because it ignores all the time spent processing the much larger amount of input data. It's also not realistic to look at workloads where all of the input is shuffled, in other words, where this ratio is one or more. This is a pervasive problem with a lot of the existing work that uses Hadoop as an example of workloads that are very throughput heavy. You might be wondering if this is just for our workloads. Here I've also shown it for the large-scale traces from Facebook, Google, and Microsoft, and there's a similar conclusion, that the amount of data sent over the network during the shuffle and output phases is much less than the input data for the job. The second issue with prior work is that it often conflates CPU and network time. In this graph, what you're looking at is the reduction in job completion time from optimizing the network, focusing on two workloads that are traditionally considered to be very network heavy, a sort workload and a PageRank workload run using GraphX. The improvement from optimizing the network here is very low because sending data over the network involves two steps. First, the data needs to be serialized from a Java object into a series of bytes, and then the bytes need to be actually sent over the network. These two things are often conflated. This is why, for example, the GraphX work showed significant improvements from reducing the data sent over the network, because they reduced both of these things. They reduced not just the time to send data over the network, but also the time to serialize the data, which is CPU time. The final question that we are wondering here is, when does the network matter? These are two workloads where we thought the network would be important, and it wasn't. We did find one workload where the network is very important. This is a machine learning workload that solves a least squared fit. Each task in this workload does a matrix multiplication using a compiled native library. For this workload, the potential reduction from optimizing the network is about 75%. The important thing to note here is that it takes a combination of many factors for the network to matter. First, the computation here is highly optimized. Each task calls out of the JVM into a compiled native library. Second, the serialization time is very low. This is because the data is already stored as an array of doubles. And finally, there's a lot of data being sent over the network by this workload. Because it does a matrix multiplication, the amount of data sent over the network is larger than the amount of input data. To summarize why our results are different than prior work, we rejected this idea that our workloads were network light. Instead, we found that prior work used incomplete metrics, for example, by looking only at the shuffle time instead of the end-to-end completion time of the job. And second, that prior work often conflated CPU and network time, that sending data over the network has a high associated CPU cost. Before wrapping up, I want to return to these limitations that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk and argue that they're not fatal. The first limitation is that we looked at only three workloads, but we used industry standard workloads used to evaluate these frameworks, and we also sanity checked our results against larger production traces. We focused on small cluster sizes, but as we illustrate in the paper, the takeaways don't change when we move from 20 to 60 machines. And finally, we focused on a single framework, Spark, but we sanity checked our results with production traces. These traces were on clusters that ran Hadoop, that ran Google's MapReduce, and that ran Microsoft's framework. And finally, we also instrumented and evaluated Hadoop on the same workloads, and we found the same takeaways. To summarize, I presented a set of three takeaways based on workloads we ran with Spark. These takeaways will inevitably change over time. The important takeaway from this work is that performance understandability should be a first-class concern. There's a real cost of running these frameworks without enough instrumentation to understand what's going on, and we should have better instrumentation going forward. To that end, and also to understand performance of a wider range of workloads, all of our instrumentation is now part of Apache Spark, and all of the traces that we collected are publicly available on the project website. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Hi, very interesting work. So have you considered streaming jobs? I think streaming jobs, I think the workload and the network communication will be a lot different from these, you know, very data parallel, kind of data heavy, analytics heavy kind of jobs, right?
So we haven't looked in particular at streaming workloads. At a high level, many of the streaming workloads do the same underlying computation, at least with Spark, as these other analytics workloads. But that would be something that's interesting to look at. So thanks.
Alex Noren from UCSD. So I really appreciated this work. And we at UCSD obviously took quite some interest in it. And so I actually have a question. You have a CDF in the paper, which I found incredibly enlightening, which you don't have in your talk. But basically, it's where you looked at the performance of Spark versus the non-compressed without the serialization overheads. And while you can never compare points across CDFs, I will do it anyway and say, let's call that a 2x difference between the compressed serialized and the decompressed deserialized. And I'm just wondering, my takeaway is that Spark is paying a tremendous amount for Scala, and that if you wanted to improve the performance of these systems, looking at the runtime and the overhead that we're paying for sort of the language flexibility might be the right place to look instead of network and disk, at least for the current situation. I'm just curious, is that your takeaway as well?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that there's a high cost of serialization, and that's exactly why for the GraphX workload, for example, there was still a low improvement from eliminating the network. And as a result of this work that we've done, the latest big initiative from the Spark community is on doing exactly that. This is a blog post from Databricks, which is the sort of main company behind the Spark project, and they just announced an initiative to start looking at reducing the serialization costs based on our work.
Hello, I'm Malte Schwarzkopf from Cambridge. So your industry workloads are kind of aggregates of usually SQL queries that do various different things. Do you have a feeling for what specific operations are the ones where selected optimizations might help? Because in our experience, for example, joins do end up shuffling a lot of data. And when we compared a 10 gigabit network and a 1 gigabit network, we ended up with a 50 to 70% improvement in runtime just from the network being faster, which is kind of comparable to your assumption that the network is infinitely fast, right? So my understanding would be the joins should benefit a lot from these optimizations, and they occur in the workloads you ran. So do you think there are specific operations that maybe should be targeted with optimizations?
Yeah, so there are certainly some join workloads that will heavily use the network, and I think your work used one example of this kind of join workload. What we found in the workloads that we looked at is that in many cases, even the joins didn't end up using the network. The TBCDS workload, for example, is very join heavy, but the way that Spark SQL optimizes the queries is it does a broadcast join. So it broadcasts, there's often a smaller table that can get broadcast, so the larger table doesn't need to get shuffled. So as a result, even for many joins, we found that the network doesn't matter. But you're right that for joins where there is sort of this big explosion of data and you can't avoid shuffling, then you would expect that the network is more important.
All right, thank you.
Hi, Chen Liu from Microsoft. I have a question regarding the background traffic. Usually in production network, you do not just run one workload. There are multiple types of traffic going on, so there is congestion and various network bottlenecks, and did you take that into account?
So for this workload, we focused just on analytics workloads and looking at the extent to which they use the network. In a lot of past work that has looked at a sort of throughput-heavy traffic versus high-priority traffic, they use analytics workloads as the example of background traffic. So I think one takeaway from this work is that it would be great from folks who have production clusters to get a sense of what these background workloads actually are, because this workload, this work suggests that using Hadoop as an example of the high-throughput background traffic is not representative.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Kate.